Well, I appreciate everybody wasn't here this morning, but if you had been here this morning, and combined with this evening as well, then I guess the message that you would get from what, in the providence of God, we've been studying this morning in Matthew 10 and this evening in Nehemiah 4, you can't have missed the message that if you are following God's way, if you are a Christian, if you are one of God's people, if you're seeking to honor Him, if you love Him, if you long to serve Him, then actually, no two ways about it, you are in a battle. That's the message, isn't it, of Nehemiah chapter 4? And it's certainly the message of Matthew chapter 10. We are in a battle. And actually, it is only because by the grace of God, we happen happily to live in the United Kingdom, in 2007, a country which hasn't really faced any major oppression of those who would claim to be Christians properly for about 360 years, that just at the moment we're in the unusual position of not really feeling the smiting of that battle too hard. It is not the norm of Christian experience through history, what we are experiencing now, here. Many other people in the world who would claim to be Christians could never dream of meeting like this in freedom, and certainly never dream of meeting in a school, hiring a public building to do it, but we have that privilege, and we must always remember that to whom much is given, much is expected, so we have a lot to live up to. Just referring back briefly this morning to Matthew chapter 10, I wonder if you might find it helpful to turn to, just because the context is so key, actually, in terms of what we've been looking at both this morning then and this evening. Matthew chapter 10, page 688. You'll remember there that Jesus said to his disciples in verse 22 of Matthew chapter 10, as he trains them, he says, "All men will hate you because of me, but he who stands firm to the end will be saved." Thus it always is for God's people, because in a world that has rejected God and hates Him, so it should never surprise us that we, as those who have by His grace come to know and love Him, are likewise hated. It was true in Jesus' time, it's true in our time, and actually it was true 400 or 500 years before Jesus was born in Nehemiah's time. Just to bring you up to speed where we're in our series in Nehemiah, but just so you've got a picture of what's going on here, it's about 400 or 500 years before Jesus was born, and about 550 years before Jesus was born, God's people in God's place, that is in Israel, were so terribly unfaithful to Him that finally all the curses that God had said He would bring on their unfaithfulness came to roost, and He sent them into exile for some 70 years. He'd said He would do it, He did it, history attests that He did it. And after 70 years, He brought them back. Well, they've been back now for about 80 years by the time we get to Nehemiah chapter 1. And yet, if you open Nehemiah chapter 1 on page 452, you'll find there that around about November or December, that is the month of Kislev, in the 20th year of this, of the kind of ruler of the whole region, a guy called Artaxerxes, Nehemiah inquires as to how they're getting on, having gone back and been back for some 80 years, and the news is not good. Verse 3 of chapter 1, those who survived the exile are back in the province, and they are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates have been burned with fire. When I heard these things, says Nehemiah, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. Well, several weeks ago we looked at what he prayed, so I don't intend to go over it again now. You can do that on another occasion. Why did it matter what state Jerusalem was in? Well, the answer is because just as God had foretold the exile, just as God had prophesied that they would be brought back again, so God had said that He would one day bless the whole world through this nation. And Nehemiah may not have understood how or why, but he did understand that God had promised, and he knew that what God promises, God will do. He sensed in himself a great responsibility to go back and to do what he could to sort out the problem in Jerusalem. And yet, as we followed chapter 2 and chapter 3 right the way through, so you are reminded again and again that Nehemiah, though he knew he was God's man in God's place for God's timing, did not believe this was his work, it was God's. He has a responsibility to fulfill the calling to which he has been placed. We were challenged, I said again this morning, by the Lord Jesus, who told his disciples that there is a real cost in following him, that there are eternal benefits, but that there are also serious costs which need to be counted. So this evening we're going to see, as we look at the latter part of Nehemiah 4, following on from last week, we're going to see that the cost move from something that maybe even in our culture in 2007 we're used to, which is mockery and derision for knowing and longing to know and serving God, into something very much more serious. Mockery does hurt, doesn't it? I mean, actually, for most of us in this country as Christians, I guess the worst kind of persecution that we would claim to have experienced is being laughed out of the office party, or maybe a bit of derision from colleagues or friends, or maybe just a bit of rejection from family. And we know all too well, don't we, that while sticks and stones may break our bones, words actually can do far more damage. Nevertheless, in Nehemiah 4, this transition from mockery to what I can only describe as battery or attempted battery means that the cost may now have to be counted in numbers of people, as it was in the New Testament, as it is all over the world now. So it was being presented to Nehemiah. They could have given up on the wall, they could have abandoned God, they could have just said, well, you've got the temple, let's just leave it at that. But they didn't. They understood that this was God's work they were about. Praise God, we don't have walls to rebuild or temples to build, but actually we do have his calling to fulfill, as the New Testament makes very clear. So we, as the church, part of the worldwide church, are being built into a city whose foundation is God. As this morning, if you're mocked for being a Christian and knowing Jesus as Lord, that is one thing. It may discourage and upset you, but you will cope. But as this morning, if you are attacked because you serve Jesus Christ, I wonder how many of us would continue. Just ask the question again. If that dreadful law had been passed 18 months ago in Parliament, and the very act of what we're doing, proclaiming Jesus Christ as Lord and Lord alone, were now illegal in the United Kingdom, as yet it isn't, how many of us actually would be here tonight? It's a big question, isn't it? Well, that was what they were faced with. As this morning, it's no surprise that the world that has rejected God likewise now rejects those who want to know him. And Nehemiah's experience is about to move into that state. Just look at verse 7 of chapter 4 again with me. When Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabs and the Ammonites, oh, and there's some more enemies that are new in Nehemiah, now the men of Ashdod as well, the whole lot of the neighbours, heard that the repairs to Jerusalem's wall had gone ahead and that the gaps were being closed, they were very angry. Why are they angry? Why do they care about the rebuilding of Jerusalem? Well, that's a complex question that we're not going to have time to fully answer, but we've seen it over these last few chapters of Nehemiah. They really don't want God's interest to stand. In fact, it goes back some 80 years to when the exiles first returned, and in the book of Ezra, which is actually just the first half, if you like, of the book of Nehemiah, in chapter 3 of Ezra, so you see there that the people wanted somehow to have some access to God. Ezra chapter 4 says, when the enemies of Judah and Benjamin heard that the exiles were building a temple for the Lord, the God of Israel, they came to Zerubbabel, who at that time was the governor, and to the heads of the families, and they said in chapter 4, oh, let us help you build, because like you, we seek your God and have been sacrificing to him ever since the time of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, who brought us. But Zerubbabel, Jeshua, and the rest of the heads of the families of Israel answered, you have no part with us in building a temple for our God. We alone will build it for the Lord, the people, the God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, commanded us. So they set out to discourage them. What's going on? Well, the very least thing that's going on is that all the local peoples wanted some kind of religious syncretism. In other words, they didn't They didn't like the exclusivity of God being God. You see it in the Samaritans, who were kind of left over by the time you get to Jesus' day. They wanted to do things their way. They wanted a God of their own making, a God of their own design, a God they could be comfortable with, who they could decide to worship in their way and following their mechanism. And actually, if Jerusalem is rebuilt and the walls are created and the temple stands and the sacrifices continue as they have been, suddenly God that they can form and mould and get their own ideas about is no longer the kind of God that they want to worship, because he has too many claims on their lives. Think about our own country for a minute. What kind of God do people want? One who they are comfortable with. That's the answer. Who makes no claims, no demands. Think back to the Garden of Eden, actually. What kind of God did Adam and Eve want? One that they could rule with. That's the answer. A God of their own design, who was, in their case, themselves. They were very angry. Yet not only is the ferocity of the attacks getting worse, so are the numbers of their enemies. I've drawn your attention already to yet another one. As you go through Nehemiah, there's a new one each time the enemies are detailed. And this one is the men of Ashdod. Verse 8, they all plotted together, and this time not to mock, but to come and fight against Jerusalem and stir up trouble against it. That must have been quite intimidating, mustn't it? These aren't just individuals. These are local officials and rulers. And they're not just officials and rulers. There's the army of Samaria as well. The king's letters giving Nehemiah permission may have given them pause for thought, but the king is 1,000 miles away and he's not going to know. They can make any kind of excuses, can't they? Maybe the raiding parties offered some kind of problem to Nehemiah. He doesn't give us the detail. What was his response? What is our response when seeking simply to honour God? The world around us rejects us, maybe gets violent towards us. How do you feel? I guess sometimes, if that kind of thing ever happens, you may feel very violent back, and that's a wrong response. Or sometimes if the world feels like that, you may feel very bashed down. Nehemiah did the right thing. Verse 9, we prayed to our God and we posted a guard day and night to meet the threat. Notice what he did. They prayed and set a guard. In other words, they had faith. Remember, we've seen it on numerous occasions that faith is not simply blind dependence. They sometimes... it's never that. It is trust in action. In other words, it's taking what God has said and holding him to what he said and getting on with it anyway. They didn't pray and do nothing, nor did they do something and not pray. They were neither depending on just nothingness and hoping God would fill in for their laziness. Neither were they taking all the authority on themselves. No, they were taking what God had said and putting the promises into action. Remember that when Nehemiah had persuaded these guys to get on and rebuild the wall at the end of chapter 2, he had said to them in verse 17, you see the trouble we're in. Jerusalem lies in ruins and its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let's rebuild the wall of Jerusalem and will no longer be in disgrace. And I also told them about the gracious hand of my God upon me and what the king had said. This is God's task. This is God's problem. I'm going to put God's promises into practice. They're doing that right now. And their faith was expressed in trusting God and doing what they could. That is the nature of faith. If you turn for a moment to the letter to the Hebrews, it has a great deal to say to us. We've looked many times before, but it bears doing again tonight, on the nature of faith. Hebrews chapter 11 and page 853. Faith, says the writer to the Hebrews in verse 1, is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. That is what the ancients were commended for. jump to verse 7. By faith, for example, and he gives a number of examples, when Noah warned about things not seen, in holy fear he built an ark to save his family. By his faith he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness that comes by faith. By faith Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. By faith he made his home in the promised land like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of that same promise. Why? Well, verse 10, for he was looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God. By faith, you might say, Nehemiah, when called by God to go and repair the walls of Jerusalem, having spent 4 months in prayer and fasting at the beginning of the book, understanding that this was the thing that God had made, was going to make his life's work, did not shirk from the responsibility. He stood in front of the king in chapter 2, took his life in his hands, and got on with the job. So what God has promised, Nehemiah believed God would do. It follows, doesn't it? Faith is trust in action, holding God to what God has said. They set a guard, they prayed, they set a guard, and they got on with the job. But of course it doesn't mean that it was easy. As you follow through the account here in verses 9 and 10 and 11, somehow these poor souls have got hassle on the outside, somehow likewise met with hassle, be it sincere, and maybe, can we say charitably, unintentional, from the inside. Verse 10, look at what happens. Meanwhile, the people in Judah said, the strength of the laborers is giving out, and there's so much trouble that we cannot rebuild the wall. It's too big a task, Nehemiah. We've got halfway. We can't carry on. Come on, Nehemiah, give us a break. Maybe now's the time to give up. But Nehemiah knew now was not the time to give up. Verse 11, also our enemies said, before they know it or see us, we'll be right there among them, and we'll kill them and put an end to the work. Then the Jews who lived near them came and told us 10 times over, wherever you turn, they will attack us. Just get the sense of what that means, can you? 10 times over. Nehemiah's trying to get these people who have got the wall halfway. He's trusting in God. Everybody's trying their best. And the neighbors of the enemies, which practically is everybody around them, comes and they say, wherever we turn, they're going to get us. And Nehemiah says, don't worry, God will fight for us. Wherever we turn, they're going to get us. Relax. It's all, wherever they turn, we're going to... 10 times... I'm not going to do it. You'll be relieved to know. But it feels, doesn't it, as if wherever they turn, there's going to be disaster. On the outside, they can't let down the guard because everything's going to fall to bits and they're going to be attacked. On the inside, they can't keep going because everybody's exhausted. It feels as if wherever they turn, there's going to be disaster. They pray. What else can they do? Well, they can pause and consider their situation. They're not stopping trusting God. They're trusting Him and sorting themselves out to trust Him better. And in the end, they undermine the surprise attack of their enemies by a call to arms. Sometimes when following what God has said, we need, as many of us know, to take decisive action to thwart disaster. Verse 14, after this I looked things over, he says, I stood up and said to the nobles and the officials and the rest of the people, listen, don't be afraid of them. There's disaster on the outside, disaster on the inside. Everything's going to collapse. What's your response? Give up? No. Remember the Lord, he says, who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, your homes. This is not a trivial matter that you are engaged in, says Nehemiah. This is life and death. This is the honor of God. This is the future of this people. Therefore, the future of God's promises. Nehemiah's assessment, as ever, drives him first to point to the Lord, and on that basis to call for action. You and I, when challenged to give up, when chided, when mocked, maybe sometimes when attacked, our temptation will sometimes be to walk away. We all know what it feels like to do that, to be challenged to do that. But God keeps his promises. Remember the Lord. God keeps his promises. He has a plan. The one thing we know God cannot do is that he cannot lie. Remember the Lord. He is great and awesome. What was it Jesus said to his disciples was the response to not being afraid? Be more afraid of God. I recommended it this morning. I think I've left it over there. Thanks, Jonathan. Can I just borrow it a second? I recommended it this morning. I like the title. I like the book as well, but I like the title. That we are constantly challenged, aren't we, to regard people as big and God small. That's a mistake. Jesus says the way to cope with fear is to see God as big and people small. Because God is always big. That's exactly... I do recommend the book. It's a great book. Edward Welsh, if you want to get it. Maybe Ray can get a copy for the bookstore or two. Can't see you, Ray. But anyway, maybe you can get a copy or two for the bookstore. When people are big and God is small, we want to run away. Says Nehemiah, don't see the size of the people. Remember the Lord. He is great and awesome. Only on that basis is there a call for action. And Nehemiah's continued answer is to plan and to have faith. What do the enemies do? Verse 15, when our enemies heard that we were aware of their plot and that God had frustrated it, we all returned to the wall, each to his own work. That is to say, we got on with the job, but from that day on, half of my men did the work, while the other half were equipped with spears and shields and bows and armor. The officers posted themselves behind all the people of Judah who were building the wall, and those who carried materials did their work with one hand and held a weapon in the other. And each of the builders wore his sword at his side as he worked, but the man who sounded the trumpet stayed with me. And I said to the nobles and the officials and the rest of the people, the work is extensive and spread out. We're widely separated from each other along the wall. Whenever you hear the sound of the trumpet, join us here. Our God will fight for us. Remember again, he did not simply use blind faith and assume it was all just going to be all right. He planned and organized. He used what one may call godly common sense to put into practice what he understood. But they got on with the job. And they worked with as the great preacher of two centuries ago described it, C.H. Spurgeon, they worked with a sword in one hand and a trowel in the other. And they got on with the job. Isn't that just the model of following God's way in our world that can't stand him? Not that we're out to stab and destroy, quite the contrary, but our weapons are not the sword of metal, but the sword of the Spirit, the word of truth. So we get on with the job and we hold in our hand the Bible, figuratively, not often literally, and it's always there. We get on with the job, with a sword in one hand and the trowel in the other, and we build in the full understanding that what we are in is a battle. So they went with the full understanding that what they were in was a battle. They knew very well, didn't they, that unless the Lord builds a house, its builders labor in vain. And unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchmen stand guard in vain. Our God, said Nehemiah, will fight for us. They may be tired, but they were determined. Faith was no replacement for action. It led to action. And Nehemiah, as you see, set the example, not simply doing what everyone else is doing. That would have been a very poor use of his strategic position, but using his resources to the best of his ability and in their most strategic way. They worked, says verse 21, with half the men holding spears from the first light of dawn till the stars came out. And at that time I also said to the people, have every man and his helper stay inside Jerusalem at night, so they can serve us as guards by night and workmen by day, even to the extent neither I nor my brothers nor my men nor the guards with me took off our clothes. Each had his weapon, even when we went for water. Nobody, as they translate that from Hebrew to English, has the first idea what that means.